Welcome to After the Buzzer, chilly scenes of winter edition. We're in the man cave, though, and we got the heater on. We got the space heat, so we feel good. I'm Mike Gross, and as always, Gordy Jones is alongside.
Hello, Mike.
And not as always, we have an Olympic gold medalist as our guest.
Yeah. First one of those. I think he's the first.
Maybe the first Olympic gold medalist. He is Ryan Neiswender, and he earned his gold medal in the Paralympics of 2020 in Tokyo. In wheelchair basketball, a Cedar Crest alumnus like your correspondent, and also attended the University of Illinois. And we're going to find out about this world and how Ryan has made this extraordinary sort of career happen. So, Ryan, welcome to the big show.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike, and it's great to join. It's great to be with a fellow Falcon. I can relate with you guys a little bit. Yeah. I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, but it is like in the teens right now, so it's cold for here. I know you guys are probably even colder, but we're experiencing a little chill.
Tell us about your beginnings with basketball and then how it turned into something more than that. Let's kind of start at the beginning of it.
Wheelchair basketball is a unique sport in the fact that, you know, 15% of the world has a disability. And globally, when you only have 15% of the world, you have to travel a little bit further to maybe get a group of elite wheelchair basketball players together to play. So you're not going to be able to go to your local high school and be able to play. I actually had to travel growing up. I found the sport when I was 8 years old. My parents took me to just like not even a showcase. It was just a demo where they had chairs there that you could try. It was, I think, sponsored by the Philadelphia 76ers, and it was in Philadelphia. Mm. And for me, my parents have a sports background. My dad coached soccer for 30 years at Cedar Crest, and I was trying every sport, but I was walking, and my mind knew that what I wanted to do, but my body wasn't able to move as fast as I liked. And so when I hopped in that chair for the first time, it was kind of like training wheels off. My mind could do everything that I wanted it to do, and there was freedom of mobility. So the world of wheelchair basketball is you have to travel pretty far. I ended up playing on a team based out of Baltimore, Maryland. But when you think about your typical AAU travel circuit, it's the same thing for wheelchair basketball.
Sure.
We have teams all across the country. There's regional tournaments. If your team goes and wins that regional tournament, then your team qualifies for nationals. And then typically at your national tournaments is when most of the college coaches and collegiate coaches will come. And that's where you get recognized and scholarship offers come. And same way as we talked about before, it's a limited demographic. So instead of having 300 D1 schools that have wheelchair basketball, there's 10 to 13. It's growing over the time. But everything is just a smaller sample size. But if you think about it, the same process of playing on a travel team, going to AAU competitions, getting recognized. And I think anybody starts out at the place where you're just playing for fun and you're figuring out what you like and what you don't. But then you kind of recognize, okay, I'm good at this, and I'm getting recognized, and I'm getting accolades. The passion paired with the success takes you on a journey of a lifetime sometimes, which I can attest to that.
The surprising thing to me about this is not that it exists, but that we don't hear anything about it. Mm-hmm. I had no idea there was college, there's intercollegiate wheelchair basketball, right? Obviously.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the beautiful things that this Paralympics did better than any other is we went from in Rio, there was, I think, 60 hours of coverage from NBC, and in Tokyo, there was 1,200 hours of coverage. Mm-hmm. And when you look at companies sponsoring, Toyota's a big front runner, Visa is a big front runner in the Paralympic movement. And I think what people are realizing is, you know, people, a lot of, like growing up, I was an inspiration, right? And people looked to me for that inspiration, or that it was inspiring that I was kind of pursuing my dreams despite having a disability. And what I think bigger companies are seeing now as the value proposition is they make up a huge portion of spending power. It's 15% of our population globally has a disability. And so we're not just investing in you because it's a nice story. We're investing in you because people where they can see themselves or people that they love reflected. Yeah. And I just, you know, the reason why Duke basketball is on ESPN more than probably any other school is because they drive the most revenue. They drive the biggest TV coverage. It's great to have wheelchair basketball, but now we're pairing wheelchair basketball with an audience and with a value proposition that can start to build that brand more and more. So I think it's just the beginning. I think the world's primed for the moment, but you're right. Nobody knows about wheelchair basketball. And I think that it's podcasts like this and stories like this that hopefully can change that narrative.
And it was, I thought evident in this last Olympic cycle that the Paralympics got more attention. I mean, I certainly was more aware of the coverage. So I think you're right about that. Let's talk about what makes you a good wheelchair basketball player as opposed to what makes you a good conventional basketball player. What's different about the game? I mean, we can think of some obvious things where pure height is a little bit different animal, but what are the dynamics of wheelchair basketball?
Well, I think in some ways they're different, but in a lot of ways they're the same. We have to start out by saying the wheelchair is not the thing that makes me disabled. It's the equipment that I use to play the game that I love to play. Just like you need a golf club to play golf, you need a wheelchair to play wheelchair basketball. But when you think about it as the lower part of my body, you look at it from if I'm in position, like from a wheelchair basketball standpoint, if I'm in position and someone runs into me, it's a charge. If I'm not in that position yet and we collide, it's a blocking foul. Yeah. When we look at the traveling perspective, you take in able-bodied basketball, you take two steps and then you got to dribble the basketball. You take three, it's a travel, right?
Yeah.
Well, in wheelchair basketball, it's you can touch your wheels two times before you put the ball on the ground. Hmm. If you touch your wheels three times and put the ball on the ground, it's a travel. Hmm. The biggest difference is there's no double dribble. So I can pump fake, put the ball on the ground, pump fake again, put the ball back on the ground. Hmm. So biggest difference there. But height-wise, I mean, I'm short. I'm 5'1", and you can see that on the court. I have to be more crafty. I'm not going to be the person that gets to post people up. I would say height is actually even more of an advantage in a wheelchair because you can tilt up on one wheel. You can try to gain some leverage and height that way, but you can't teach height. And that's in able-bodied basketball and that's in wheelchair basketball. Especially the way the games are also moving in similar directions. You know, in the 90s, it was big men dominated, you know, like the last big man that I see dominating as a true big man was probably Shaq. And you can think about those dominant years with Kobe. But now we look at it, and it's like these big guys are shooting threes. They're running up and down the floor. Sure. They're not a liability on defense. They're shooting free throws better than anyone else. And the ones that aren't able to, a.k.a. like guys like Dwight Howard, they went from being superstars to very quickly becoming a role player and kind of not that valuable of an asset. And in wheelchair basketball – and we've changed the game a little bit in the U.S., and we pushed the globe this way where it's if you're tall, you're going to be tall and fast, and we're going to run and gun, and we're going to spread you out and shoot threes, and we're going to try to attack you in transition and press you full court and throw different waves at you. And so we've taken the game and kind of Golden State Warriored it into wheelchair basketball. So a lot of similarities. Three-point line's the same. The back, like we play on the same court that Kevin Durant and Team USA played on, and there really is not any difference other than we're playing in a wheelchair, which to a lot of people, that's a huge difference. To me, it's kind of like if you practice long enough one way, your body adapts, and you just got to do it and perfect the craft. So I don't know if that gives you the full-blown scope, taste into wheelchair basketball.
Interesting.
So what stood out to you, other than the obvious, about the Paralympics in 2020 in Tokyo? You beat Japan in the finals after you had some quarantine issues following your semifinal. What stood out to you about the whole experience?
Well, I think a couple things. One, you know, the Paralympics in 2020 kind of also reflected the magnitude of where we are globally. Mm-hmm. You go to opening ceremonies, and I think that's something that every Olympian and Paralympian you picture. Like, it's the moment you've arrived. You've seen it on NBC for how many years?
Right.
Where they call Team USA, the crowd's going nuts, you're waving to everyone, and you're in your opening ceremony. 2020 gear. And not that it wasn't special, and it's not that I won't remember it for the rest of my life, but you walk into a stadium that's supposed to fit, I don't know, 100,000 people, and there's no one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's empty. You know people are watching on TV. Still an awesome moment, but then you play 8 games in 12 days, and every game has no fans. You can hear the pin drop. You can hear coach saying every word. And even in the gold medal game, imagine playing the host country, a gold medal match, what that crowd would have been like. And some people would say, you know, maybe you had an advantage because it would have all been going for the other team. But I look at it, and we've been in big moments our whole life. And it's almost more difficult and more strange to have no one in the stands in the biggest game of your life, the biggest game of your career, the thing that you've worked for so long. But then I look at my experience at the Paralympics. Our coach after every game would say, you know, this game has no memory, and what you did yesterday will have no impact on what you do tomorrow. And the point was to set the scene to say, like, we got to show up tomorrow and be the best team in the world just like we were the day before. And if we mess that, if we don't bring that to the table on any given day, a team can beat us. But in the gold medal match, after we won, he came in, and you have 5 minutes to kind of get ready and whatnot before you have to go back out for the medal ceremony. And he paused and he just said, you know, I've said this after every game, this game has no memory, but people do. And everybody in this room will remember this moment for the rest of their lives. But I think that that's like a good lesson for anybody anywhere, that it's how you treat people, it's the time you spend with people, and it's what you do with the people that you love the most, that people that you, that will remember. They won't remember the stat line. They won't remember all the work that you did for your job or for all these things. They'll remember like how you treated them, how you interacted with them, and maybe the things that you accomplished along the journey together. And so I love that. And that's probably something from my Paralympic journey that will stay with me for quite some time.
That's really great. I mean, it certainly is. I mean, just watching on television, every time they play an anthem when somebody wins a gold medal, it certainly is a lump in the throat moment. What was it like for you?
Well, what was even more unique and added another like layer of just it being special is typically some of the organizing committee members put the medal on you. But due to COVID, it was either you had to grab it yourself or your teammate put it on you. And our coach said, like, you're not putting your gold medal on yourself. Like, your teammate next to you is going to put it on. But your teammate is like, these are guys that I've spent 9 years playing basketball with. I've spent more time arguably with them over the summers than my own family. And so they've become my brothers. And for them to put the gold medal around your neck is just a moment you'll never forget. And then to go side by side with those guys as your flag raises higher than anybody else's, and you get to sing that national anthem, it's just it's the moment that you've waited for your whole life. And even in the midst of nobody being there, that moment can never be taken away. And that it was really special.
That's great.
Yeah, I can see so. What's now? First of all, Ryan, you work for Visa, is that right? And tell us a little bit about what you're doing outside of basketball, or let's say using this basketball to create a career for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, because when I was looking for a job, wheelchair basketball, I went overseas and played professionally for a season. And a lot of guys will go do that for multiple years and make a career out of it. For me, I found better balance in the United States with my wife being here. If we went overseas, she wouldn't have a work visa. So it just supports our lifestyle better. But working for Visa, I got the job actually because they have an Olympian and Paralympian business development program. So they sponsor the games. And they look to incorporate their sponsorships into the culture of their business. So they believe that high-performing athletes will turn into high-performing business professionals. And it's really cool because as athletes, you get done with sport or you're in the midst of sport and your resume just has all these accolades from sport, but the business world doesn't really recognize that as true resume-building material. And I put quotes around that. And so Visa does. And I did a rotational program where I got to experience different parts of the business. And now I've landed, I'm a global risk strategy and operations manager, and I look to just implement how do we go to market to our clients, how do we operate internally, how do we track mechanisms, streamlining processes. So yeah, I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but it's just been something that I've been able to channel passions that and strategies that I've learned at the pinnacle of sport and transfer those skills into being a really effective and efficient business professional.
And at the same time, are you going to continue to pursue, you know, future Paralympics?
Yeah, so I'm going to be going, 2024 is going to be it, but I'm going to go for one more. Yeah. I think the combination of, it's enticing that it's only 3 years instead of four, and me being 27 years old, I just feel like I have more left to give to the game. So giving it one more go, I train in the mornings and train in the nights, but... And what's nice is when you come off, you can't always be peaking, right? So when you come off of a gold medal, you take a little time off. And not just complete time off, but you don't have to be going 4 or 5 hours a day like I was leading up to the Paralympic Games.
And your wife is a college was a college athlete also, is that correct?
Yeah, so we met at the University of Illinois. She was a D1 soccer player. So we got the competitive juices flowing. We're loving... the Illini basketball is, they're killing it right now, so we're loving to watch that. But, yeah, competitive household, she was a great soccer player. And it makes it fun because I think we can relate what it takes to get to the highest level of sport, and she's fully supportive of that goal of mine.
I know that you occasionally use Cedar Crest facilities, or you did when you were up here. And I know that I've talked to Rick Dissinger about you, and that was the athletic director there. Tell me a little bit about what that's been like, the connection to the old alma mater.
Cedar Crest has always been a place that not only feels like home, because growing up I trained there as a high school athlete. My dad coached there for 30 years. My mom and dad taught there for a really long time. Like, there are so many connections there, but then... I mean, Rick Dissinger was my economics teacher when I went to school there, and now he's the athletic director. And previous to Rick was Chris Groff, and he was a teacher of mine as well. And so I just felt a lot of connections. And one of the coolest things is basketball can take you all over the world, and sometimes you like to come home, and you like to see, just getting to spend time with my family and my parents. And all my family except me, this is still... in the Lebanon County area.
Right.
And so when you come home, you still need to train. And Rick Dissinger has opened that door up anytime that I come home, that he'll do anything he needs in order to open it up and make sure that I get gym time. And gym time's hard to come by, and it's typically not free. And so the combination of just the support that they've given me along this entire journey, I said it in some interviews right after the games, and I'll say it again, this isn't just a Ryan Nice Wonder gold medal. My family, my friends, the community of Lebanon County, Illinois. I mean, there's so many different ties that helped along that journey. And so Cedar Crest played a huge part. They continue to. I have a great relationship with Rick Dissinger, and he's someone that he's always in my corner, and he's always wanting to do anything that he can to help me along the journey.
It takes a village, as somebody once said.
It does.
Ryan, I assume the next basketball you play is not going to be in the Olympics or Olympic. There's got to be some stuff leading up to that. So tell us a little bit, and we'll wrap up with this. Tell us a little bit about what's next for you in basketball.
In the United States, I kind of talked about in Europe, there's a professional league that you can get paid. In the United States, they haven't figured out how to monetize it yet, but there's like a semi-pro league where I play on a team called the Charlotte Rolling Hornets, and we play throughout the year, and we do some adult tournaments, and then we'll go to a national championship tournament. So I'm getting runs in with them, and it's been good to just develop relationships on that team. And then for me, each year there's a major competition, so I'll be trying out for the United States men's national team towards the end of summer. The date isn't set yet, but in sometime the time frame between October and December, barring COVID issues. There's a World Championships that will be held in Dubai, and that's where all the teams, similar to what was in the Paralympics, will have a World Championships this year. And it's very similar to, if you think about like the World Cup, you have the Olympics and then you have the World Cup for soccer.
Yeah, yeah.
We do the same thing, but just for wheelchair basketball. So this is our World Championships or World Cup, so to say. So those are kind of this year goals for me, are to continue to play and hopefully win as many games as possible with the Charlotte Rolling Hornets, and then take that success and just the training that I've been doing for that and bring it to the world's biggest stage and try to win a World Championships for Team USA.
Ryan, you were born with atherosclerosis. I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. And I think maybe some people would be more self-pitying than you obviously are. Can you talk about how you work through that, how you managed to succeed as you have?
I think oftentimes we all have different insecurities. Some are more noticeable than others.
Mm-hmm.
But it's our ability to, I think we need to first wrestle with the acceptance of that. And that took a long time. I mean, growing up, you try to just fit in and be as normal as possible. And probably the greatest compliment someone could have given me was like, I don't even notice that you have disability. I was yes, I'm doing my job. But I think later in life, what I recognized is accepting who I was and leaning into that, it actually becomes my greatest strength. I'm more recognizable. I'm more noticeable. I have more opportunities and more doors have opened because of the success that I've had, and also because of just the lessons that I've learned and things that I've had to overcome at such an early age. I think a lot of times people have those lessons and have to overcome those things, but they're maybe later on in life. And having that happen earlier in life, I can take those experiences, I can share them with others, and being comfortable in who you are allows you to be able to show others that they can be comfortable in who they are. And so I just think that for me, it was the recognition that this doesn't have to be a limitation. It actually can be the thing that propels me to go do some of the greatest things and my biggest accomplishments in my life. And like I said, whether you have a quote-unquote disability or not, we all have those insecurities. Embracing those and leaning into those is really how we go from where we are to where we want to be. And a lot of people just, they're not able to get over that hump. And so that would be my biggest encouragement. And yeah, it is, in some ways, it's a crappy hand that you can get dealt sometimes in life, and they happen at the most unexpected moments. But it's accepting those and for what they are, and being able to move through them, not past them, I think has been something that's really helped me along this journey.
You said you started playing at age 8. When did you feel like you really could excel at basketball? When did it really the light bulb really go off for you?
I think my dad probably knew before I did, but there were some people when I was like 12 years old that were coming up and saying things like, this kid has like, your son has some potential. Like if you invest in this, if you kind of allow him to play on these teams and travel the country and invest financially, you're going to reap the benefits, and he could go to college to play this. He could potentially be on a national team one day. And I think it was my ability to read the game and then my speed to be able to execute the things that I was reading at a really high efficient pace. But my parents, I think, are the reason why I am where I am today. They drove me twice a weekend to Baltimore, Maryland. They gave up those weekends. My dad traveled to every one of my basketball games. My mom typically would stay home with my sisters. Sometimes she would come as well, which was awesome. I loved when everyone was able to come. And then as we all got older, they all came, and they all supported me. So lots of time and sacrifice was put into like this goal and this dream. But I would say when I was age 12, there's actually a video clip of someone interviewed me, and I was like, I want to go to the University of Illinois. And we kind of have that clip, like, as this, like, little 12-year-old Ryan is saying this, and then spoke it into existence, six, 7 years later.
How did you get involved in the national program? How did that come about?
It's a combination of, I was ready for the moment, but it was like right timing. So I graduated in 2013 from Cedar Crest.
Right.
And in 2012, the games were in London.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, your junior year is kind of when people start recruiting you.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened that in 2012, they took bronze. Mm-hmm. They changed coaches, and the new coach was the coach of the University of Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And he was recruiting me.
Mm-hmm.
So I had put an application in to get an invitation to the senior men's national team.
Mm-hmm.
And I had already made the under 23 national team, so I was already on their radar a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to the tryouts, I had a really good tryout.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think they were looking to, he was looking to choose a team maybe that like wasn't filled with all of the wheelchair basketball superstars that have been around for a long time, but he was looking to build that next wave, that next generation youth up into the program. And so he took me, and I ended up starting on that team. I ended up playing, having a really good year mm-hmm. with the national team, and that kind of propelled me and my career for the next 9+ years.
I think it's pretty great that you look upon your teammates who you've been with for all this time as brothers to this point. These are, I'm guessing, friends for life now, correct?
Yeah, we invite each other to our weddings, still talk to, I work, one of my colleagues actually was one of my former teammates. But yeah, we communicate often, and I think we're all spread out throughout the country, so it is mm-hmm. a unique, we're not like hanging out on a daily basis, but they're just people that you always know you have each other's back, and mm-hmm. at any moment you could call them and talk about something, you could go on a vacation with their family at any time. So definitely a brotherhood for life. Anytime you win a gold medal together, it's kind of the stamp that ties you together through thick and thin.
Sure. Mm-hmm. This is something Fred Shiro said back in the 70s when he was coaching the Flyers. He said before a deciding Stanley Cup Finals game to his players, you win this game, you walk together forever. And I think that resonates with any championship team in any era. So I think that's another example right here.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And the other unique thing is I do think that it ties you together forever.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I recognize is, you know, the guy I was July of 2021
mm-hmm.
is the same guy that I am sitting here January of 2022.
Mm-hmm.
I have a gold medal. The experiences have changed who I am for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of just recognize, like, the gold medal's just sitting here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more, when I look at it, the chapters of the story, kind of, I get to peel those back and I get to learn from each chapter along those journeys.
Yeah, what it represents, and, sure. Yeah.
And excited to be able to kind of continue to dive in that and try to reflect a little bit more on the lessons that I've learned.
Well, Ryan Neiswender, you are the man.
Let me just say that
without reservation.
No doubt.
It's not just because you're a Falcon.
although that helps in this particular forum.
Yeah, that helps. So we're glad we're able to make this happen, Ryan.
Yes.
And we'll be watching. I didn't know there was anything to watch, but now I'm going to be watching because I'm intrigued. I love basketball at every level, and I will be certainly paying attention to this and whatever happens to you as you go forward. Thanks so much for spending some time with us, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, thanks, Ryan. All right, be well.
See ya.
So there's an inspirational guy, and I'm glad we're able to get him on.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a struggle, and he's not around here, as he's in North Carolina, which is part of it, and he's got a pretty he's got a pretty serious job, it looks like. We went back and forth a little bit with him and his people before we could make it work, and I'm glad we did.
I'm glad you were able to do that, and I'm glad he was able to speak with us. Obviously, just a great guy, and it's, you know, and as he said, it's, you know, he doesn't look on it as a limitation. It's just not a limitation to him, and I'm always impressed with people like that because, you know, there are people who have far less to deal with who are you know, much more down in the mouth than somebody like that.
He gave when you asked him that question, I thought that was a tremendous answer, because he's talking about how he can turn it, he turns it into a positive. And you know, let's be honest, this has gotten, look what this has gotten me.
Right.
This is, absolutely.
So good for him. So we move on to other topics, and first I get to whine about the Packers.
Oh, whine away, my friend.
Something for the listeners to look forward to. Here's the part where you can go get a sandwich.
I was expecting more Twitter angst, because I know so many people who are Packers fans. It's amazing. Some guy came up to me at the gym, and we were talking the other day, and, I'm a big Packer fan. You got it. Another one. You are.
Think of all the Packer fans in your life. Beside myself, Rich Scarcella, Audrey Snyder, Eric Thomas. Who am I forgetting? Well, Mark Eckel, who's been on this show.
Right, Mark Eckel. There's a couple others.
Jeff Young is a Packers fan.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, okay. Jeff Young. And of course, you and Audrey both – co-owners of the franchise.
So heads are going to roll, I tell you.
You got to do what you got to do.
But at any rate, the loss is obviously in large part on their special teams. They had a field goal and a punt block, the punt block for the tying touchdown. But I think also a sizable amount of it goes on Aaron Rodgers, because he didn't play nearly as well as his numbers would indicate. He was 20 for 29, but throw that out. I mean, he was just not... They had an opening drive touchdown, and after that, they just kind of wallowed about and did nothing.
Well, actually, the first when I look at quarterback numbers, the very first thing I look at always, and I think it's the most important, is yards per attempt.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not get it done in that way. There was a lot of. He seemed to have less nerve than he usually does.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I don't know if knows if everything that's happened to him this year has. Mm-hmm. Has gotten into his head a little bit. I don't want to assume that. I think people assume that kind of stuff way too easily. The other interesting thing about this is, when you talk about special teams, I mean, their special teams are so bad that they regularly impact the game.
Yes.
I'm
aware of this.
I'm talking to the audience now, not to the co-host. It's funny because. You know, when I cover Penn State and I do those grades after every game. And so I do a grade for offense, one for defense, one for special teams, one for coaching. And I would say the majority of the time, special teams, I look back and I think, it's kind of a wash. Yeah. I mean, other part, I've struggled to have something to write about the special teams most of the time. Not nearly always, but the majority of the time. For your special teams to be bad enough to continually shoot you in the foot.
Just hideous.
It's not easy to do.
No, just hideous.
At that level, it's inexplicable.
I can't remember the last time they were good. In fact, during the game, I texted Mark Eckel, speaking of which, and I said, when's the last time they had good special teams? And he said, maybe... that Super Bowl.
I have a feeling Vince would not have tolerated that special team.
No, it was Mike Holmgren when they beat the Patriots in the Super Bowl. Desmond Howard ran back the kickoff for it. That was what he, and that's 1996.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago. Mm. So it was really an incredible display. I mean, getting back to Rodgers for a minute, there are those who compare what may be the final play of his career in Green Bay to one that Brett Favre had in 2007. In that case, Brett Favre forced a pass against the Giants in the NFC Championship game. It was intercepted by Corey Webster. The Giants win in overtime. And there was like a behind the quarterback view, and there were like three guys standing open in the middle of the field. Well, Rodgers' final pass, so he forced one downfield to Devontae Adams. It fell incomplete, and then they had to punt. And Alan Lazard was standing in the middle of the field 10 yards in the open, which never happens in the NFL.
He really was, and I didn't notice that live.
Nor did I.
But certainly I've seen enough of it on ESPN in the last week to know what you're talking about. The interesting thing there is that was somewhat characteristic of Brett Favre.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not at all characteristic of Aaron Rodgers.
I mean, it looked like he had his mind made up from the snap that he was going to throw it deep to Devontae Adams, and that was that. Yeah. I mean, he targeted Lazard once in the game. He targeted Randall Cobb once in the game. And Lazard has been playing really well for the last month. And it was just really, as you said, it really kind of an inexplicable performance.
It was very un-Rogers-like in so many ways. He's such a confident, sort of freewheeling, but good judgment.
Yeah.
Freewheeling, like Favre, I thought was freewheeling, I'm going to throw seven interceptions once in a while.
Yeah.
That's not Rogers.
No.
But this was really strange, and I now think it's more likely than not that he's not going to be a Green Bay Packer anymore.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because today, as we sit here, Nathaniel Hackett, the Packers offensive coordinator, just got hired by the Broncos as their head coach. So now there's speculation that Rodgers and Davante Adams will both end up there.
And it seems like Rodgers, who has had issues with coaches, does not have an issue with that guy.
No, it not at all. Like, no, the obvious exception being the playoff game against San Francisco. They've been pretty simpatico, and so we'll see how that goes out. It would be kind of interesting to me if he ends up in Denver, since that's where Peyton Manning played his last few years too. Yeah. So, I mean,
and got a ring.
Yeah,
got a ring when he really was kind of shot.
He was. Yeah. Their defense kind of got a ring for him.
Yeah, yeah.
But be that as it may, I mean, it's just really, I've said this before in this forum, it's really kind of mind-boggling to me that the Packers have had 30 years of Hall of Fame quarterback play, and they won two Super Bowls.
Yeah.
That's kind of shows you how hard it is, for one thing.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think that fact kills them as a franchise. I don't think that's a total insult to them as a franchise, although it is criticism of them as a franchise a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, think about how many times they were in the NFC Championship game, I think four other times with Rodgers, and lost other than the year that they won the Super Bowl.
It seems like there's at least that many. Seems like you would know better than me.
Yeah. But at any rate, the one really galling one was Seattle in 2014. I'm still getting therapy over that. But
work through it.
My therapist tells me I'm doing fine.
It takes some time. It's only been 7.5 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Come on.
So anyway, that will bear watching where he ends up. I mean, he said he's going to take his time before he decides what he's going to do. And Davante Adams is a free agent. So, I mean, we could see a whole new era of quarterbacking there. I mean, he's 38. It was bound to happen within the next few years.
Yeah,
anyway,
right. So. Right. So it's not a disaster in that sense. It if you're a Packer fan, but it's troubling in the sense that I'd be surprised if Jordan Love is the answer.
I'm not feeling Jordan Love. granted, it's still a small sample size, but ooh.
When Jordan Love was in college, I get these little gifts from SIDs because I'm into football writers.
Right.
I got a little packet with those little heart, those little candy heart things for Jordan Love.
How about that?
Jordan Love for Heisman. Yeah.
There you have it.
So that was nice.
I didn't know they still did that, to be honest with you. Because I know that for years they, you get things from wherever, like some, off the beaten path place, to pushing somebody for an All-America team. But I didn't realize they still did.
Yeah, they still do a little bit of that. Not quite as much as they used to. Anywho.
So we move on from there. Ben Roethlisberger announced his retirement today, and that is really kind of a complicated legacy, to say the least. He had two sexual assault allegations, and now he's saying he's going to retire and spend time with his family, the usual sauce. So, but obviously a great player, and for a long time. How do we look at Ben at this stage of his life?
Well, the sexual assault thing, we seem willing to forgive that in America. We seem willing to, over the long haul, forgive that. Now, there are exceptions. Certainly, think about how Kobe Bryant is perceived now, and he probably was guilty of whatever you want to call it, rape, sexual assault, whatever it was, right? I mean, I'm not being unfair. I don't think.
No, that was what...
Same thing with Roethlisberger. I believe that the woman that he's married to, his relationship with her began after all of that. I think that's right.
I believe that's correct.
And it does certainly seem on the surface, from what it's possible for us to know, that he's become a family man and settled in a little bit. I certainly hope so. On the football side, how do you assess him football-wise?
He was unlike any other quarterback, and a big guy and kind of speaking of an improvisationalist, he was a guy who just sort of made stuff up and was really good at it. It really
was amazing at extending plays, yes, for a guy who was not particularly mobile.
Yeah,
right.
Because I mean, he's a huge, yeah, guy, but he managed to make those little subtle shifts,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
things. And
but
know,
even more than Brady, like Brady was sort of mobile within the pocket, but,
yeah,
Roethlisberger could really run around and extend. You know, shed tackles. He was,
yeah,
so big. And,
yeah, it really, yeah, kind of an interesting. Probably stayed, you know, 2 years too long.
Yeah, he did. There's
you
no
know,
question.
He really couldn't, the last 2 years, really couldn't throw the ball downfield at all.
And part of that was that they didn't have options, or maybe, or did they? The
well,
Steelers, I'm,
yeah,
talking about.
Yeah, they've had, you know, Chase Claypool, Juju Smith-Schuster. They've had some guys. I mean,
I mean another quarterback option. Like,
oh,
what were they, like, what could they have done?
No,
it was
Mason Rudolph,
like,
is their backup.
Yeah,
they,
right.
They really didn't have.
Dwayne Haskins.
So, I mean, you know, is Pittsburgh an option for Rodgers? I mean, he kind of talked it up during the season. Is that where he ends up? That would be interesting.
Yeah, apparently he and Tomlin are kind of,
yeah,
look at each other very favorably.
But, I mean, it gets back to the point. I mean, if Rodgers decides to move on from the Packers and vice versa, I mean, they could really get a king's ransom for him and kind of like hasten their post-Rodgers,
yeah,
rebuild.
Yeah, then you got to be smart. Then you got to be smart and make good choices and build.
But,
yeah,
but they could really, I mean, if that marriage is over, the next chapter for the Packers could be a good one because of him.
Because, and the contractual situation is what?
I'm not sure. I know he's on the books for like $40 million this coming year.
Yeah.
And they have real problems cap wise. I think that might be the last year for that.
Yeah.
So
it would be a big unloading of cap space.
Yeah. So yeah. So that bears watching, certainly. We also wanted to talk about the NFC Championship games. After the divisional round, all four games decided on the last play. The most amazing game of all was, of course, the Bills and the Chiefs, where the Chiefs, for some reason, the Bills, with 13 seconds left in the lead, they decided they were going to kick it into the end zone. To me, why don't you just, like, squib it, whatever?
A lot of people have said that. Yeah,
yeah.
And I agree. I agree. Maybe they were thinking that Hill's going to be back there.
Yeah,
Well,
if it was the Packers, he would run it back for a touchdown.
Yeah, yeah, right. But that's off.
That's
the
a separate
off
category.
The charts. Yeah, that's another animal. The fact that they only had 13 seconds.
It's kind of amazing.
That's what argues for what you're saying.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it really was.
I mean,
and then it looked like they were in the prevent defense. I don't know enough about what they were doing X and O wise to know that that's what it was, but that's sure how it looked.
I know. The Chiefs are amazing to me. Mahomes is so much fun to watch, and when they get it rolling, it's like they're on fast forward. It really is impressive.
Yeah. How about that long touchdown late that Hill scored?
Yeah.
Where it looks like two guys have an angle on him,
yeah,
and he's taunting them.
Yeah.
He's like, you don't have an angle on me, dude. Which they could, and then some people said they had to throw the penalty for taunting there.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It's the old line, if we're even, I'm leaving.
Yeah,
that applies.
I'm gone, baby.
That applies
I'm
to Tyree. So at any rate, it leaves us with Chiefs, Bengals, Rams, Niners. The Niners have beaten the Rams 6 straight times, and you know, you think nothing is forever, but on the other hand, the Niners are just such a physical team, and the Rams just have kind of wilted against that.
The Rams don't seem like a physical team, although I think they have more the last month or so.
Maybe so.
I think they've looked a little, and you know, Aaron Donald has been such a force, and he's a physical guy.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any problem in that area. Shout out to Nick Scott, by the way.
Yes, how about that?
our guy from Lancaster, who I became friendly with because I would, over the years, and intercepted Tom Brady, cut in front of, jumped around
really
on Rob Gronkowski.
Really
good play.
And
it looked like he was going to be a special teams player and not much else. Even last year, it didn't look like, when he was in the game at safety, it didn't look like he was very advanced in terms of coverage. He's made a huge leap.
He really has,
and he's starting now. I'm not sure if it's because of an injury or
it
not,
is
but
an injury,
he's starting and playing well.
Yeah, so how long was he in Lancaster? He was born here, but how long did he live here?
I think it was just to like age 10.
Okay, and then he went to high school in Virginia, right?
No, he went to Massachusetts.
Okay, Massachusetts, okay.
His father, and I talked to his father a little bit today because I'm trying to get a hold of Nick for a story. His father was had some big job in the Boston Public Schools. Mm-hmm. So then they moved up there. Uh-huh. And then he got a job with the Bill Gates Foundation in education. So that's when they moved to Virginia. And actually, he was a Bill O'Brien recruit.
How about that?
Yeah. Yeah. He was aware of him when he was in Boston, you know. Mm-hmm. And now his father teaches at Harvard.
Well, that's his dad's got to be an incredibly impressive guy.
Yeah.
He worked for the Bill Gates Foundation, and now he teaches at Harvard. Other than that, what have you done with your life?
He's done okay. He shows up.
Chiefs-Bengals is interesting because the Bengals beat the Chiefs fairly recently in Cincinnati. Right. So, and Joe Burrow has obviously kind of taken that next step. I mean, he got sacked 9 times last week, and they still managed to, I mean, largely because Ryan Tannehill was awful.
Yeah,
through 3 picks.
Which surprised me.
Yeah,
it surprised me. Yeah. I sort of have been on the Ryan Tannehill is underrated bandwagon, and
that was an ugly.
No, I didn't see any of that game because I was working, but I saw highlights and read stuff about him. Anyway, 9 sacks of Burrow. Mm-hmm. They do not have a good offensive line, and I feel like they've gone as far as you could go with a bad offensive line.
I suspect.
I love Burrow.
Yeah,
love
I do him. Too. I do too.
Yeah,
I think
really good.
I think another year, another draft, another free. I think they're going to be a real force.
That's
But I think this is as far as they go. That's my temptation.
And look what you're going into at home in their building and Big Red and.
Big Red drawing it up.
Have you ever seen better quarterback play on both sides than in that Kansas City Buffalo game? I never have.
Crazy.
I never have. Josh Allen. I can't believe he's like superhuman. I can't believe how fast he is.
Yeah.
When you see a guy that size, a quarterback, turning the corner on defensive backs, not scampering to get out of bounds, turning the corner. And he's become a great at the passing game.
He made some great throws last week. And I'm sure you saw that Mahomes went out of his way to talk to him after the game. He said, we're going to be doing this a lot. And I suspect that's true.
That could very well be.
And I hope it is.
And the other, the other thing, it's interesting, if we are having a transitional phase here, when maybe Brady and Rodgers and Roethlisberger are saying goodbye, well, some other guys are stepping in who are going to be fun to watch.
And the guy Herbert out in San Diego, he's another good young quarterback. So it'll, and maybe, you know, Trevor Lawrence, maybe now that he'll have Byron Leftwich as his head coach, maybe that'll get him up to speed.
Yeah.
Because I think he's got physical tools.
He's got, no doubt, he's got the tools and seems to have the right demeanor and all that stuff, the other thing I've seen, a little bit on social media and stuff is people saying, "Boy, if you don't have one of those 5 quarterbacks, meaning Burrow and Herbert and Mahomes and Allen, and if you don't have one of those guys, you're screwed for the next 10 years."
Could very well be.
It could be true. Yeah.
Could very well be. So I'm sure they mentioned Jalen Hurts in that too.
They did not.
Oh,
they did not.
Oversight.
They did not. Go figure. And if you don't have one of them, then you're in this crazy quandary about what do you do next? Do you invest in a guy who's not at that level?
That's
the Eagles' situation.
Yeah, it kind of is.
And other teams, too.
Yeah, it kind of is because, you know, I mean, it's interesting you say that because, you know, the Bears forever have been trying to find a quarterback. And, you know, speaking of special teams, they look for other angles to win the game.
Yeah.
And that would be one of them. They coach up their special teams. They get the right guys in there. I mean, it hasn't really worked out for them other than rare occasions like Matt Nagy's first year. But, you know, it's kind of like this is the sacrifice you have to make. You have to, like, you know, have certain guys on your roster who aren't necessarily positional guys but are there to win you the game in that third phase that people, you know, Green Bay being an obvious example, overlook or just – don't seem to even care about.
We should note that the Bears have Justin Fields, who is kind of in the same category as Trevor Lawrence. Maybe he's going to.
Yeah.
He hasn't really had a chance yet to show us what he is.
He had some moments. I mean, they played Pittsburgh, and I thought he played really well there. And so, yeah, it's again. I mean,
and he's in that mold. Very athletic, can move around and make stuff happen. Yeah.
So he's got some physical tools. It's just a matter of getting the right guys around him, getting the right staff in place, all that stuff. So we'll see how it works out for Justin. So we wanted to shift gears to the Baseball Hall of Fame. One member in this class, and that would be that David Ortiz. So Mike, there were some performance enhancing stuff
swirling around him, but he got in, whereas Bonds, Clemens, etc., did not get in. So I ask you this. If Bonds and Clemens had been nicer to reporters, did they get in? Is it that simple?
I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think so, but maybe I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, and let's be clear. Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens aren't nice to anybody. I mean, they're just assholes.
That's true.
As human beings. Right. And I'm sorry, but you can say, if you're Roger Clemens' defender, you say, well, you don't know him. Well, okay, I don't know him. He's an asshole. And Barry Bonds, the verdict is even clearer on him.
Correct.
However, I think that the history of writers and in this kind of thing, I remember people saying that Steve Carlton was going to screw himself for the Cy Young. Well, that didn't happen. People said Ted Williams. Well, there was that one famous one where he hit 400 and didn't win the MVP or
that's
whatever.
Correct. But
Bill James, our old standard bearer, Bill James, went back and looked at it, and Williams actually did great over the years in award voting. Mm-hmm. He didn't generally. So, Bonds got 66% of the vote, right?
Yeah.
You got to get 75. It's an unusual sort of situation.
Right.
So I think there are some people who sincerely, I don't have a position on this I'm happy with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. Because I see both sides of the argument. It's like, how could it be a Hall of Fame when you don't have the all-time home run leader, the all-time hits leader, you know, and a multi Cy Young Award winner in it? And I get that argument. But on the other hand, they clearly cheated.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
There's two very definite sides to this argument, and I think both arguments have their merit.
Yeah, yeah, you know? I do too. I used to think it would be the coolest thing in the world to have a vote for the Hall of Fame. Now I'm glad I don't. I'm so glad I don't. I mean it. I used to write about this every year. When the results came out, I'd write a column about it. And now I'm going to write about it on Sunday because I think this is kind of a unique situation. I haven't done that for years because it's just, it's almost wearying, you know.
And here's
another thing. We hear so many people say, correctly, that Bonds was a Hall of Fame player before his body changed.
Correct, he was.
But he wasn't one of the 10 best players who ever lived before his body changed. He was going to have maybe a Frank Robinson-ish career. And I'm not saying Frank Robinson
wasn't
a great, great baseball player. He was. In fact, I think he's a little underrated historically.
Possibly so.
But he's not one of the top 10 players of all time.
No, probably not.
Bonds, he went from Frank Robinson to Babe Ruth when his body changed. Mm-hmm. And he became that. So people would, this whole thing about, well, he would have been in anyway, you know, it's a little, he would have been, but it's a little different,
which, you know, is obviously his thinking, right? Because he saw how much people, you know, paid attention to the home run, and that was going to be his thing, you know. So said McGuire, and that kind of spurred him along these lines.
You know, that's not exactly an inspirational story.
No, it is not. I mean, no, it is not.
Come on, dude.
But the
other thing is, there's one guy in this group that, to me, would not have been a Hall of Famer pretty clearly without the juice, and that's Sosa.
Mm-hmm.
Sosa, before his body started changing, was kind of a speed
just
guy.
Just a guy.
He was just a guy. It almost seems crazy to, like, eliminate this era from the Hall of Fame. We're just going to have this block of baseball history that is not accounted for in the Hall of Fame. It's almost like we're headed in that direction, except Bud Selig's in the Hall of Fame, who presided over baseball during this era and kind of, loosely presided over baseball. I mean, to say that he looked the other way for all this crap is an understatement.
Yeah, I agree.
And he's in the Hall of Fame. So it's, you have it.
I saw a writer the other day, he said, I always try to vote for the greatest player from every era, so I'm going to vote for the guys from the steroid era. So that's it. That was an interesting argument to me, too.
Yeah.
You know?
To the extent that the Hall of Fame is a baseball history museum,
right?
Can we just be so obstinate about sort of punishing Bonds and Clemens and Sosa and whoever else that we want to create that gap. I don't know that you do.
I don't know.
I think I would hold my nose and vote for these guys. I don't know what I would do with Sosa. Sosa's one I really, that's a really good point.
I like that.
Anyway, I'm going to try to write. I don't know. I'm not even sure what I think. Remember the other day we were talking about
Randy, with Chris Jones, we were talking about how you write a column and then decide what you want to say.
This is going to be the exhibit A of that.
Well, there's, I mean, you know, you're not a machine. It's like, you know, it's like you're human and you have to sort stuff out. That's just the way it works.
Yeah, that is just the way it works. And the way we make it work, ideally, is by writing about it and I'm not going to get to a place where I would have a ballot that I would be happy with.
Yeah.
That's for sure. I know that.
Mm-hmm. So it really is a very complicated, to use that word again, question. And I don't know how you resolve it. It's like one of those things, it's a case-by-case thing with every voter. Like, which way, what are your parameters? That's what it comes down to.
And the other thing is that's a little bit unique about it. Now, we're really rambling here, so we have to, wrap it up a little bit. But the other thing about it is this idea that 75% is a threshold, which is kind of unique in anybody voting for things. Right. And I'm not saying it's bad. Right. I remember Rocky Colavito.
Yeah.
Lived in Berks County.
Yeah.
And he was really a curmudgeon. So when I was working in Lebanon, I had his number somehow, and I called him two or three times, and he thought he should have been in the Hall of Fame.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, he had a lot of power. He was a Ralph Kiner-ish kind of player. But marginal for the Hall of Fame, no question. No doubt. But anyway, he would colorfully bitch about, you know.
As only baseball players can.
Yeah. But he didn't really realize that, you know, sometimes Hall of Fame voters turn in a blank ballot.
Right.
Because they genuinely don't think anybody deserves to be in this year, and my ballot will count against that 75%, you know what I mean? Like, the blank ballot counts. And he started talking about that, and he didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
So when I told him that,
oh my gosh,
I really pissed him off. And then he was going nuts, you know. It was kind of funny, but I mean, it's, you know, and that was 100 years, not 100 years ago, but that was 30 years ago, and you know, so much more has happened to complicate this process.
It's really an interesting thing. All right, now speaking of votes, we're gonna take a short discussion here at the end. Joel Embiid is averaging 35-11 since Christmas, and he's kind of vaulted to the top of the MVP discussion. The other guys in that discussion being Giannis and Nikola Jokic and Steph Curry, although
really
marginally to me.
Not really.
I think he should win it personally. I think he's
if the season ended today.
Yeah.
I mean, we're less than halfway through.
Yeah, so we'll see how his health holds up. That's always the X factor. But at the same time, I think that he's got to be right there, and the odds say that, and deservedly so. I mean, because the rest of the team has been in flux. They've had guys in and out with COVID and injuries, and you know, the whole Simmons thing has kind of been the cloud over them forever. So, I mean, I think he certainly deserves it if he continues along this path.
Yeah, I think right now he would probably win it. I really think there's been a change in this in the last 2-3 weeks. I think people have really recognized what he's doing.
Yeah.
It is with a less than ideal cast around him, I think we could say safely, and with the whole Simmons situation simmering in the background, and they've played pretty well, at least in terms of W's and L's.
Yes.
They've been pretty good for the last 3 weeks or so. So he's in the lead, and it's not like Jokic. Jokic is a magical player to watch. He's tremendous. He's really unique. It's such a goofy looking body for an athlete and everything else. But he's really fun to watch. But their team is pretty ordinary too.
Yes.
So it's not like he's dragging them, you know, to heights. Giannis is what he is. I mean, he's pretty formidable. There's no doubt about that. And they're still contenders. I mean, I would probably put him second, Jokic third, maybe.
I think that's probably a good call. Yeah, Giannis. I still go back to the finals last year when they showed what Giannis looked like when he came into the league and what he looks like now. And it looked like two different people.
Yeah, that's one of those things that from at least in my perception, it happened fairly gradually.
Yeah.
And when you look, but when you look at here and there, it's really dramatic.
Yeah, he was like 6'9" and who knows what, and now he's like 6'11" or 7 feet, and he's just sculpted.
That guy won the genetic lottery, man.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, the book that Maron Fader wrote about him, which came out, you know, fortuitously right as they were winning the title, was really kind of got into his background and just how, you know, they were really in desperate circumstances back in Greece.
Yeah.
And he kind of, you know, learned to play on this, you know, godforsaken court and, you know, kind of came out of nowhere. And it's really kind of an amazing story of what he's become.
Yeah, and when I say he won the genetic lottery, that sells him too short because he's done a lot to make this happen.
Oh, my God.
As a teammate, as a hard worker, at building his game, give him enormous credit.
Yeah, you read that book and the work ethic comes through, but also just the fact that how much he cares about his family and his teammates and just how much he wants to be great.
He's a solid citizen.
Yeah, so he can win all the MVPs, as I'm concerned, you know. The guy just seems like he's just a real prince of a guy, and he doesn't seem like one of those people who's going to be changed by success in the least.
Oh, yeah, well, it hasn't happened so far. I think it's happened in a positive way.
Yeah.
I think he's become more of a leader and recognized the responsibility he has. I think it's made him blossom. Yeah.
So good for him. So I guess that's where we'll end.
With
the Milwaukee Bucks of all places.
Go figure. Well, that was fun.
Yes, it was.
Thanks very much to Ryan Neiswender. That was cool to talk to him.
Yes, it was.
And this has been After the Buzzer. He's Gordy. I'm Mike. And we'll do it again soon. See you later.
See you later.